Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Maxwell here to welcome you to Michael's Saturday Surprise for Saturday, October 1st, 2016. Well, because it's Halloween at the end of the month on October 31st, I thought I'd pick three Myths and Legends episodes that have a nice, scary feel to them. Let's hear our first episode that's going to deal with Tutankhamun's tomb. The thing of it is this is a credible find, an archaeological find, and yet some people claim it was cursed. So let's hear Tutankhamun's tomb from the Myths and Legends series.
At first, I could see nothing. But presently, as my eyes grew accustomed to the light, details of the room within emerged. Strange animals, statues and gold. Everywhere, the glint of gold. With these words, Howard Carter described the greatest archaeological discovery ever made. Nothing before or since has equaled the splendor and magnificence of the tomb he had uncovered in 1922 in Egypt's Valley of the Kings. These stunning artifacts filled the tomb of Tutankhamun, an obscure pharaoh of the 18th dynasty. Until Howard Carter broke into his resting place, Tutankhamun was known only by one or two minor objects gathering dust in museums. Nothing like this. But from November 1922, his name became a household word. Tutankhamun was Egyptology. He also became the subject of a legend woven around a curse which was said to bring death to anyone who desecrated his tomb. Woe betide any grave robber or archaeologist who disturbed the 3,000-year slumber of the pharaoh Tutankhamun. Howard Carter had long been fascinated by the Valley of the Kings, a royal necropolis hacked out of the barren sides of a sun-blasted valley 600 miles up the River Nile in Upper Egypt, near the small town of Luxor. The valley provided a discreet cemetery for some of the best-known pharaohs of the New Kingdom, which lasted from 1577 to 1085 BC. Seeking security for their mortal remains and the treasures buried with them, the pharaohs were hidden in tombs hewn out of the harsh rock of the valley, rather than under great pyramids of stone. Egypt's famous pyramids had proved rather too obvious an attraction for grave robbers. In 1914, Howard Carter began excavating the valley in association with George Herbert, the 5th Earl of Carnarvon. The Earl was an archaeological dilettante who spent much time in the warm climate of Egypt after a car accident left him in frail health. Carter was Carnarvon's field director, a stubborn, short-tempered, self-educated man who had first come to Egypt in 1892. Most archaeologists believed that the Valley of the Kings had yielded up all its secrets. But Carter was convinced that there were some areas which had not been subjected to systematic examination, as they were covered with the debris of previous excavations. Carter's hunch was correct, but he had to wait until the beginning of November 1922 before he uncovered the steps in the rock which were to lead him to Tutankhamun. At the 12th step, he found a sealed doorway. The doorway had been hidden from previous excavators by the remains of workmen's huts erected during the building of the tomb of Rameses VI. It bore a seal, that of Tutankhamun. Carter carefully filled in the entrance he had uncovered. He then cabled Carnarvon, who arrived in Egypt on the 24th of November. With him was his daughter, Lady Evelyn Herbert. The excavation was reopened, only for Carter to discover that the door at the foot of the steps showed signs of having been opened and then resealed. Had the tomb behind it been plundered? The door was removed, and then 30 foot of rubble left in a passageway to deter robbers. In the rubble, Carter found this exquisite head of the young pharaoh Tutankhamun. Carter now moved down the passage towards a second blocked door. It, too, bore signs of tomb robbers. He steeled himself for disappointment. With trembling hands, he made a hole in the door large enough to shine a light through. In a frenzy of anticipation, Carnarvon hissed, "Can you see anything?" After an agonizing pause, Carter replied, "Yes, wonderful thing." The treasures in the antechamber, uncovered by the two men, were the start of a stunning process of discovery. As Carter and his team penetrated deeper into the tomb in successive seasons of work, objects of ever greater beauty were brought to the surface. But it was not until the autumn of 1925 that Carter came face to face with Tutankhamun. The body of the pharaoh lay within a series of richly decorated coffins, like a Russian doll wrapped in jewels and gold. Over the head, shoulders, and chest of Tutankhamun's mummified body was a death mask of sheet gold. Bandages were removed, and Tutankhamun's face was seen again for the first time in over 3,000 years. Scientific examination of the mummy established that the pharaoh had died sometime between the ages of 18 and 20. Professor Douglas Derry, who examined the body, noted a small scab by Tutankhamun's ear. The cause of his death remains a mystery, but murder cannot be ruled out. Mystery also surrounds the sequence of deaths which raced through those associated with the excavation of the tomb. There was a portent of disaster while Carter opened the tomb. A caged bird in the entrance to his house at Luxor had been eaten by a cobra, the serpent who spits fire on the pharaoh's enemies. News of the incident quickly spread through Luxor. Had the dead king's cobra vented his anger at the betrayal of his master's tomb? The first to die was the 57-year-old Lord Carnarvon. He did not live to gaze on the face of Tutankhamun. On the 6th of March 1923, Carnarvon was bitten on the face, probably by a mosquito. While shaving in his suite at the Winter Palace Hotel in Luxor, he nicked a small pimple which had formed over the bite. According to one of his colleagues, an unspeakably filthy Egyptian fly then settled on the seeping spot and further infected it. Carnarvon fell ill. He was taken to Cairo, where blood poisoning and pneumonia set in. Lady Carnarvon flew out from England and rushed to his bedside. the world waited to hear the fate of the celebrated archaeological aristocrat. The novelist Marie Corelli issued a warning that the most dire punishment follows any rash intruder into a sealed tomb. Shortly afterwards, on the 5th of April, Carnarvon died. At the moment of Carnarvon's death, in the small hours of the 5th of April, all the lights in Cairo are said to have gone out. It was the first of several sinister events which accompanied his departure from the world and fueled rumors of the curse of Tutankhamun. At Highclere, Carnarvon's home in England, his terrier bitch is said to have set up a terrible howling when he died and then dropped dead herself. Some claim that the suppurating wound on Carnarvon's cheek was in exactly the same place as the scab on the face of the long-dead pharaoh. As he lay dying, Carnarvon might have reflected on the words of Arthur Weigall, an archaeologist long resident in Egypt, who also acted as a special correspondent for the Daily Mail newspaper. Weigall had told Carnarvon the tale of an earlier aristocratic archaeologist, an English nobleman who had brought a mummy to England. A series of tragedies followed. The aristocrat's arm was blown off in a shooting accident. His house burned down. His mistress was lost at sea. As Carter's team prepared to enter Tutankhamun's tomb for the first time, Carnarvon was in a jocular mood. Weigall, observing from the sidelines, half-jokingly told the travel writer H.V. Morton, "If he goes down in that spirit, I give him 6 months to live." Half-joking or not, Weigall's prediction came true. Within 6 months of photographing Carter, bringing out the first of the treasures, Carnarvon was dead. Even as he fought for his life, the newspapers were running stories on the curse of the pharaohs. But how mysterious was Carnarvon's death? His constitution had never been strong, and it had been further undermined by the excitement of opening the tomb. Nevertheless, the legend of the lights going out in Cairo when Carnarvon died was confirmed by the British High Commissioner in Egypt, the distinguished soldier, Field Marshal Lord Allenby. Allenby apparently asked the engineer in charge of the city's electricity supply for an explanation of the blackout, but none was forthcoming. Arthur Weigall, whose half-joking remarks sparked the legend, was no friend of Carnarvon and Carter, and strongly disapproved of their methods. He had another axe to grind. Carnarvon had given the London Times newspaper exclusive rights to the Tutankhamun story. Weigall, a special correspondent of the Daily Mail, was one of many disgruntled journalists trying to beat the Times embargo. His warning to Carnarvon probably owed as much to frustration as any belief in an ancient curse. Nevertheless, the suspicion that there was more to Carnarvon's death than a septic mosquito bite suited the popular image of ancient Egypt. It satisfied a deep-seated expectation of supernatural evil associated with a strange and distant civilization. One which, by the end of the 19th century, was being explored not just by archaeologists, but a new breed of wealthy tourists. Henceforward, the death of anyone even remotely connected with Carnarvon, Carter, and the discovery of the tomb was hailed as clinching evidence of the long arm of the pharaohs. There seemed no shortage of evidence. In September 1923, Carnarvon's younger brother, Aubrey Herbert, died suddenly after an operation to remove some teeth. An early visitor to the tomb had been Prince Ali Kamal Fahmy Bey. He was murdered by his wife at London Savoy Hotel. Carnarvon's secretary, Richard Bethell, died unexpectedly of a coronary thrombosis. His father, Lord Westbury, committed suicide by jumping from his seventh-story London apartment. At his funeral, Westbury's hearse ran over and killed a small child. Arthur Mace of New York's Metropolitan Museum had been Carter's right-hand man and present at the opening of Tutankhamun's coffin. His health broke down, and he died in 1929. Arthur Weigall reminded Daily Mail readers that some very strange things have happened in connection with the Luxor excavations. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, declared himself a believer in the curse. Arthur Weigall was well aware of the legends surrounding the gods of ancient Egypt and the power they could exert on an active imagination. In the years before the First World War, Weigall had befriended an American artist, Joe Lyndon Smith, who spent a lifetime painstakingly reproducing the wall paintings in the temples and tombs of the Valley of the Kings. Smith was fascinated by the heretic pharaoh Akhenaten, who had attempted to supplant the cult of the god Amon-Ra with a new religion based on the worship of the sun. The headquarters of the priests of Amon-Ra were at the great temple of Karnak, near Luxor. After Akhenaten's death, they took their revenge. He became the ancient Egyptian equivalent of a non-person. Akhenaten was erased from official history, and a curse was placed on him, condemning him to wander forever through the afterlife. In the winter of 1907, Joe Lyndon Smith decided to lift the curse. He enlisted Weigall's help. They wrote a play, which they planned to perform in an eerie natural amphitheatre on which they had stumbled at the head of the Valley of the Queens. Smith's wife, Corinna, was to play the accursed Akhenaten, and Weigall's wife, Hortense, was also given a part. It all seemed great fun, but the play was never staged. On the 23rd of January, 1908, Weigall, Smith, and their wives gathered in the rock-bound amphitheatre for a rehearsal. As the names of the ancient gods were invoked, the sky was split by a ferocious hailstorm, scattering the native servants. Worse was to follow. That night, Corinna was struck down with a terrible pain behind her eyes. Hortense was taken ill with agonizing stomach cramps. Amon-Ra visited them in their dreams, striking the afflicted parts of their bodies with his flail. The women were rushed to hospital, where Corinna was diagnosed as having severe trachoma. Hortense underwent an operation which nearly killed her. Had the gods decided to remind these puny mortals of their frailty, or did the near tragedy have more to do with coincidence? Corinna had been complaining of eye trouble for some time, and Hortense was at the beginning of a difficult pregnancy. But the drama of these events could not have been lost on Arthur Weigall. And like any Egyptologist worth his salt, Weigall knew of the elaborate precautions that were taken to safeguard the dead pharaoh in the afterlife. The Ankh was the sign of life itself. Keeping eternal watch at the entrance to the boy king's tomb was the jackal-headed god Anubis, the ancient Egyptian guardian of the dead. One of the sentries in the burial chamber was the goddess Nephthys, with outstretched wings ready to enfold Tutankhamun. The lioness god Sekhmet and Djemisu, with his savagely hooked beak, stood guard. Protective formulae called on the gods to watch over the dead pharaoh on his long voyage through the afterlife. Hundreds of mannequins, each in Tutankhamun's likeness, stood ready to act as servants when the gods required him to perform a task. The pharaoh was also provided with personal protection. This dagger was found in the linen folds which swaddled the mummy. In the afterlife, Tutankhamun lived on as a conquering warrior. Although he had never drawn a bow in anger, his military deeds in death, once depicted in the tomb, assumed a life of their own. Could the pharaoh smite his enemies from beyond the grave? In 1934, the American Egyptologist Arthur Winlock disagreed. He pointed out that of the 26 people who had been present at the opening of the tomb, 6 had died within 10 years. Of the 22 who had witnessed the opening of Tutankhamun's sarcophagus, only 2 had died. The 10 people who had witnessed the unwrapping of the mummy were still alive. Howard Carter, surely the prime target for the wrath of the pharaoh, died of Hodgkinson's disease in 1939, at the age of 64. Hodgkinson's disease is a rare condition, and it is said that Carter died a lonely and disappointed man. But this 17-year delay perhaps stretches the curse too far. Harry Burton, the man who photographed every detail of the tomb and its contents, died in 1940. Lady Evelyn Herbert, Carnarvon's daughter and one of the first to enter the tomb, survived until 1980. Professor Derry, who took his scalpel to the mummy, lived to the ripe old age of 87. The curse seemed singularly selective. There is no shortage of pseudo-scientific explanations for the curse of the pharaohs. Journalist Philip Vandenberg has suggested that the tombs of the pharaohs were perfect breeding grounds for bacteria, which, over the centuries, could develop unknown and deadly forms, lying in wait for the unwary archaeologist. The ancient Egyptians were expert poisoners. They were familiar with substances which did not need to be swallowed to prove deadly. They could be absorbed through the skin. Wall paintings could be treated with these substances before the chambers in the tomb were sealed and made airtight. Tomb robbers always bored a small hole in the chamber wall before entering to allow fresh air to circulate. So did Howard Carter, but he pronounced Tutankhamun's tomb to be sterile. Another theory, put forward in the late 1940s, suggested that the ancient Egyptians protected their holy places with radioactive rock and smeared the floors with uranium. But the insect which killed Lord Carnarvon was not radioactive. Perhaps the most outlandish claim for the power of the curse concerns one of the worst disasters in maritime history, the sinking of the liner Titanic in 1912. Students of the incident, in which 1,500 passengers and crew lost their lives, know that the liner was lost on her maiden voyage after colliding with an iceberg in the North Atlantic. Those who believe in the curse of the pharaohs remain convinced that tragedy was ensured by the presence on board of an Egyptian mummy. It was the body of a prophetess who had lived during the reign of Tutankhamun's father-in-law, Akhenaten. An ornament found with the mummy bore a spell. "Awake from the dream in which you sleep, and you will triumph over all that is done against you." One thing is certain. Howard Carter's sensational discovery acted as a powerful stimulant to the popular imagination. Hollywood loves a sensation and eagerly embraced the curse of the pharaohs. In 1932, the Universal Studio produced The Mummy, a horror feature in which Boris Karloff starred as a supernatural bandaged menace. It was the first in a long line of mummy movies. When the priceless treasures of the tomb of Tutankhamun travelled abroad, the public who queued to see them were as familiar with the legend of the curse as they were with the matchless beauty of the objects on display. Over 3,000 years after his death, Tutankhamun was big business. The security men closed the doors in the shadow of the Ankh, the symbol of life. Even in the jostling crowds, the contents of the time capsule which carried Tutankhamun through the afterlife have the power to take the viewer on a mental journey through time itself, just as they did Carter and Carnarvon over 70 years earlier. Their eerie beauty has the power to still even the most skeptical observer. In 1972, Tutankhamun's golden mask was crated for shipment to Britain for an exhibition at London's British Museum to mark the 50th anniversary of Carter's discovery. The precious cargo arrived safely and was carefully unwrapped. The tension was almost as palpable as it had been in 1925. In charge of the operation at the Egyptian end was 52-year-old Dr. Gamal Meres, Director General of Antiquities at Cairo Museum. He believed he was living proof that the curse did not exist. But on the day that the shippers arrived to remove the mask of Tutankhamun, Dr. Meres died of a heart attack. The death of Dr. Meres could be seen as another in a long line of sudden and sometimes spectacular exits by people connected to Tutankhamun. For those who believed in the curse of the pharaohs, it provided further evidence of the dangers of tampering with their remains and the relics which accompanied them on their endless journey through the afterlife. Could Carter and Carnarvon really have fallen foul of a curse? Carnarvon was indeed struck down even before the bandages were peeled from the face of the pharaoh. But Carter, who always laughed at the idea, lived on for another 17 years. Was the legend the creature of Arthur Weigall's animosity towards Carnarvon and Carter? Weigall died in Egypt of a fever, a common enough occurrence, but one which earned him the honor of becoming victim number 21 on the Boy King's hit list. Tutankhamun was buried over 3,000 years ago. It may be another 3,000 before we can bury the myth of his curse.
Folks, that was Myths and Legends and Tutankhamun's tomb. Now, let's hear another Myths and Legends story. This time it's not as credible as our archaeological find, but it's certainly mysterious. Here is the Loch Ness Monster from Myths and Legends.
Loch Ness, moody and secretive, is the largest freshwater lake in Britain, gouged out by glaciers thousands of years ago. It is 23 miles long and a mile wide. In places, Loch Ness is over 1,000 feet deep. The loch lies between Fort Augustus and Inverness, at the northern end of Scotland's Great Glen, the fault line which cuts across the Highlands, sculpting an area of great scenic grandeur. Mystery and romance lurk below the ruined battlements of Castle Urquhart on Loch Ness's northern shore. The play of light on water is never-ending. Loch Ness's waters are cold and dark. Peat washed down from the surrounding hills produces a swirling murk below 50 feet. Even the lights of a modern mini-submarine cannot penetrate the enveloping gloom. The perfect lair, perhaps, for a large, reclusive, and ancient creature. From the Dark Ages, sprites and water horses were said to haunt the loch. The story goes that the 6th century saint Columba was confronted by a monstrous beast, which, in saintly style, he sent packing. In the 18th century, the blasting of a military road beside the loch roused two leviathan creatures from their slumbers. In the 19th century, there were sightings of what were described as giant salamanders. Most of the locals were convinced that there was something odd swimming in the waters of Loch Ness. Two roads run along the shore of the loch. On the south, there is General Wade's military road, built in the 18th century. To the north, another road runs from Fort Augustus to Inverness, skirting Urquhart Castle. In March 1933, John Mackay and his wife, the tenants of an hotel at Drumnadrochit, were driving back from Inverness along the northern tip of the loch. Suddenly, Mrs. Mackay saw what she described as a huge black body rolling up and down in the waters below. As the commotion subsided, she saw two black humps moving across the surface of the loch. They rose and sank before disappearing in another thrashing of water. In November of the same year, the first alleged photograph of the monster was taken by a Mr. Hugh Gray. It appeared on the front page of the Daily Sketch newspaper on the 6th of December. The Sketch's rival, the Daily Mail, responded by sending a big game hunter, Montagu Weatherall, to track down the beast. Weatherall and his cameraman prowled the shores of the loch. Almost immediately, the intrepid big game hunter discovered a set of strange footprints. He staked his reputation on their authenticity. The spoor was dispatched to London under tight security. The Mail fanned the flames of public fascination with the Loch Ness monster, now popularly known as Nessie. On closer examination, however, Weatherall's mystery footprint turned out to have been made by a stuffed hippopotamus foot. So much for the big game hunter. The spring of 1934 saw the publication of a new photograph, taken by a gynecologist, Robert Kenneth Wilson. It was to be dubbed the Surgeon's Photograph, and appeared in the Daily Mail on the 21st of April. One of a series of photographs taken by Wilson, it became the classic image of the monster. For his part, Wilson never claimed to have photographed the monster, only an object moving on the loch. Scientific opinion was not impressed. But many people were inclined to believe a local man like water bailiff Alex Campbell, who encountered Nessie on numerous occasions.
Way back many years ago, I took one of the police force with me out in my boat. There were sheep stealing going on at the time, and the police and our department worked hand in hand, you see. I took this chap out, Constable John Fraser, one of the finest men I ever saw or met. And we're rowing quietly along, crossing the loch to the far side, where there's a farm, sheep farm. About midway through the midway across the loch, rather, we heard this upsurge of water. Mind you, that was after midnight, dark, and John, Constable Fraser, was absolutely shattered. Oh, heavens, he said, "What's that?" I said, "Don't worry, it'll be all right. It's the creature itself." Well, we listened to it quite clearly, breathing. Like that. That was the sound of a breathing. Astonishing. And gradually, it faded gently away, and it disappeared. I mean, it's submerged. We could hear the sound. Everything flat calm, you see? Beautiful.
At about the same time, Richard Singh had also seen something unusual.
But quite a different shape.
Well, that was in August 1934, and my parents and sisters and I were staying at Fort Augustus in the hotel, and I was shaving and looking out onto the loch on a very fine morning with no wind, the loch as clear as a mirror, and there was a black hump there. At least it looked black the way the lighting was. About 3 feet across, I should say, and a foot above the water at its maximum, and about a quarter of a mile out. Mm-hmm. Well, I called the others, and as we were watching it, it suddenly started to move off in a northerly direction. I should say making about 15 miles an hour, because we paced it. We got the car out and we paced it, and we followed it for 2 miles up the side of the loch.
Singh reported other witnesses.
Yes, there were some workmen by the bridge which we crossed in Fort Augustus, and we pointed it to them, and they regarded it as a matter of course. They said, oh, aye, that's the monster.
An everyday occurrence, in fact.
Well, so it seemed then.
Theories abounded as to what the monster might actually be. But amid the speculation, the majority of sightings had a familiar ring to them, prompted perhaps by the surgeon's photograph. The slender neck, flat, snake-like head, humps, and rough, elephant-like skin occurred time and again. The monster beloved of media and public alike. From time to time, the monster has appeared on dry land. On a warm afternoon in July 1933, the Spicers, a couple from London, were driving along the old military road. Suddenly, about 50 yards ahead, they saw what they described as a 30-foot beast emerging from the undergrowth by the road, which it briefly blocked. Mr. Spicer later described it as a loathsome sight. The Second World War thrust Nessie to the sidelines, although this did not prevent members of the Royal Observer Corps stationed in the area from making a number of sightings. The bombastic Italian dictator Benito Mussolini also claimed that his bombers had attacked and killed the monster. But this imaginative propaganda coup failed to deliver a death blow to British morale. In the 1950s, a spate of sightings and photographs rekindled public interest in the secret of the Loch. Urquhart Castle was the scene of one of the most celebrated when, in July 1955, an Ayrshire bank manager, Peter McNab, photographed what seemed to be an enormous black creature cruising on the surface. In 1958, BBC Television mounted a monster hunt of its own in the same spot. With the aid of an old steamer moored in Urquhart Bay, a favourite haunt of the Loch Ness Monster, it brought modern science to bear on the mystery. An echo sounder scanned the water below the steamer. On the deck, the ebullient presenter, Raymond Baxter, marshalled a team of frogmen and arrays of lights and underwater cameras. Nessie did not come out to play with the BBC's frogmen. It was left to local man Lachlan Stewart to describe how he came to photograph the monster.
I got up as usual that morning, about 6:30, to milk the cow, and on looking from the window I saw what I first thought was a boat travelling in the direction of Dores from Urquhart Castle. On looking again a few seconds afterwards, I saw another thing appear just behind the first one. It was then that I thought it must be the monster.
Did he believe in it?
I did not. And, I grabbed the camera from the sideboard, called to a friend who stayed with me, and I dashed down to the shore. But this time the monster had crossed the moor and was heading towards fires on my side of the moor. So I just got the three humps in the viewfinder and snapped.
This is, in point of fact, not very far from where we are now. Just across the other side of the loch there.
Yeah, this is more. I think then that it saw me because it rushed over at terrific speed and submerged.
And that was the last it saw.
The BBC failed to find the monster, but the echo sounder installed on the puffer did pick up something unusual. Speaking to the BBC's new radio camera, Baxter described how the echo sounder, which had been developed to help trawlermen locate shoals of fish, was capable of picking up even relatively small individual objects. Excitingly, and perhaps conveniently, a very clear and substantial signal was picked up just as the boat was manoeuvring into position. when the technician who was operating the machine was asked to identify the trace, he was unable to say exactly what it might be. The contact had been recorded just as the BBC's boat was coming out of the deep water of the loch and onto the shallower shelf. The marking was
Much stronger than we usually get from the type of fish we've been getting around here. And, well, I wouldn't like to see it when it is entering, as it's certainly coming from.
It was submerging as the boat approached. One scientific explanation of the Loch Ness phenomenon was that the loch harbored a breeding population of plesiosaurs, a species of marine dinosaur assumed to have become extinct 65 million years ago. Could some have survived to enter the loch at the end of the Ice Age? The coelacanth was thought to have been extinct for 70 million years until several were fished up in the 1930s. So why not plesiosaurs in Loch Ness? But it is not clear that the loch was ever connected to the sea, or if it was, how a tropical marine reptile would have adapted to the conditions there. And would the loch's fish stock sustain over 20 hungry Jurassic predators? In the 1960s, new efforts to solve the mystery were made by the Loch Ness Investigation Bureau. Boats equipped with sonar plied to and fro. Autogyros buzzed overhead. Submarines plumbed the depths. Tim Dinsdale was one of the full-time monster hunters who came to the loch in search of Nessie. In April 1960, he created a sensation by filming what he claimed was the monster. The object he caught on his cine camera seemed to be swimming on the far side of the loch, leaving a zigzag wake. Dinsdale was convinced that only part of the creature he was filming appeared above the surface. If the monster is a plesiosaur-like creature, its appearance would depend on the eyewitness's viewpoint and the creature's attitude in the water. Tim Dinsdale saw what can best be described as an upturned boat shape moving away from him towards the northern shore of the loch. Other sightings have caught what may be the monster at different stages of its progress above or just below the surface of the loch. When one collates the hundreds of sightings of Nessie, the majority build up into the plesiosaur profile advocated by many of the monster hunters. One of them was Robert Rhines, president of the Boston-based American Academy of Applied Sciences. In the early 70s, Rhines set out to photograph Nessie underwater. Like the BBC, he chose Urquhart Bay. Here, in the summer of 1972, Rhines deployed two boats equipped with a system of stroboscopic cameras linked with sonar arrays. The sonar would record the presence of the monster and trigger the cameras, whose flash would illuminate Nessie. This was the result. An object recorded on Rhines' sonar and underwater cameras. When computer enhanced, it produced this image. Was this the flipper of the Loch Ness monster? Experts estimated its length to be about 7 feet. 3 years later, Rhines obtained two more photographs of the monster. The first was of its gargoyle-like head. The second, supposedly, was the creature's upper torso, neck, and head. But underwater or above, the camera can lie and the eye can mislead. At the appropriate distance and in the right conditions, a log, rock or tree trunk, a dead horse or a swimming deer can metamorphose into a monster. So can a surfacing otter. Was it an otter that the Spicers saw crossing the road on that summer day in 1933, its size and shape distorted by the heat haze shimmering over the tarmac? The naturalist, Peter Scott, showed how easy it is to create the sudden illusion of something strange moving about in the loch. from Nessie to Frogman in one simple move. At the range of a mile, a small powered boat moving in and out of the bays of a loch can create the wake of the monster. In calm weather, the wake of a boat consists of a number of individual wave fronts which move at an angle to the line of the wake. They can appear as a series of humps travelling across the surface. The wake of a steamer can set a trap for the unwary observer. Skeptics point out that many of the modern eyewitness reports of a humped creature ploughing across the loch can be attributed to surface wave action. Natural phenomena may explain some of the famous photographs of Nessie. It's been suggested that Hugh Gray's photo, the very first, was in fact a Labrador dog rolling around in the shallows. Peter McNabb's photograph has been dismissed by some as the wake of a ship which had sailed by just before the picture was taken. The suspicion of fakery also hangs over a number of other photographs of the monster. Frank Searle, a London greengrocer turned monster hunter, claimed to have caught a plesiosaur-like Nessie on camera on no fewer than 8 occasions in the 1970s. But are these photographs, among the clearest ever produced, no more than dinosaur montages photographed against a watery background? And what of the surgeon's photograph? Robert Kenneth Wilson always maintained that he did not believe in Nessie. In 1994, his famous photograph was revealed as a fake. One of Wilson's collaborators in the hoax, Christopher Sperling, told the press that Nessie had been fashioned from plastic wood and mounted on a toy clockwork submarine. Apparently, Wilson was surprised by a water bailiff after taking the photographs. The evidence was scuttled and now lies somewhere on the bottom of the loch in only 3 feet of water. Intriguingly, Christopher Sperling was related to big game hunter Montague Weatherall. Cinefilm has also raised more questions than it answers. Tim Dinsdale's film was analysed by an RAF photo reconnaissance team who declared it to be an animate object. Others believe it to be a small powered boat belonging to a local farmer. ...1987 saw the launching of Operation Deep Scan, a sonar sweep of Loch Ness with the twin aims of flushing out Nessie and gathering information about the loch's unique ecology. Deep Scan's chorus line of cabin cruisers covered about 80% of the steep-sided loch. The operations director, Adrian Schein, a Loch Ness expert, remained suitably sceptical about the existence of its most famous resident.
We don't expect a Jurassic reptile to come out of this loch. A large fish, perhaps. But that would be interesting enough for me.
Deep Scan sonars made some tantalizing contacts with large targets, but they failed to provide conclusive evidence of the existence of Nessie. The monster remained as elusive as ever. But one element of Deep Scan cast serious doubt on the photographs taken in Urquhart Bay by Robert Rhines in 1975. An underwater camera was lowered into the same spot. The water was not as deep as Rhines had claimed, and there was something else down there among the slithering eels. This is Rhines' photograph of the so-called gargoyle head of the monster. And here, in the same spot, is a rotting tree stump to which the gargoyle head bears an uncanny resemblance. But still the sightings continue. In 1994, a holidaying Canadian couple's camcorder filmed a strange disturbance on the surface of the loch.
What the hell is it?
Put that thing on zoom?
As close as I can get. John?
Nah.
Yes. Look at it. Look at how fast that water is going.
A Sunlight and shadow cast their spell on the loch as powerfully as they have ever done. In so magical a place, it is all too easy to conjure up a creature swimming just below the surface. And yet Loch Ness still keeps a tight hold on its secrets. And the hunters still come. Extensive searches and the most modern sonar equipment have been unable to produce conclusive evidence of a monster in Loch Ness. Submarines and divers have failed to make what would be one of the scientific finds of the century. Is it possible that a 65-million-year-old survivor could account for the images recorded by seemingly reliable witnesses like Richard Singh, a future Nobel Prize winner, Peter McNab, and Lachlan Stewart? And the grainy cinefilm made by Tim Dinsdale in 1960. Or are we all the dupes of the ingenious hoaxer surgeon, Robert Kenneth Wilson? The plesiosaur theory raises more questions than it answers. But might Nessie be another creature entirely? In 1932, a Miss MacDonald claimed to have seen a large crocodile-like creature with a short head making its way up the shallow River Ness towards the loch. Her description suggests a Baltic sturgeon, a migratory fish which can grow to a great size. The early legends of the loch often refer to a strange fish. Perhaps there really is something very large and very old swimming purposefully through the gloomy waters of Loch Ness.
Well, folks, that was Myths and Legends, and the Loch Ness Monster. It's time for our final installment of excitement and fear. I think this program's the scariest one. You tell me later on, after the show, if you think this program was the scariest or not. This is Myths and Legends and Famous Ghost Hauntings. Enjoy the program. Thank you.
From the earliest times, people have believed that spirits remain at their place of death or burial. The Greek philosopher Plato wrote of souls that roam about tombs and burial grounds. At the Tower of London, the spirits of the men and women who lived and died in this ancient building, part palace, part prison, seem to have been absorbed into the very walls. The tower and its surroundings are pregnant with images from its turbulent past. Some of them are still seen today. The tower's colourful rituals conceal a dark past, drenched in betrayal and murder.
Past witnesses, case knows well.
The red coats of the guardsmen recall the blood that has flowed here. Few places in the tower have a more sinister reputation than Traitor's Gate, the water gate on the Thames through which prisoners were brought to the tower to avoid popular demonstrations. Many came by this way, few went out. At the top of these steps lay the rack and the thumbscrew. There was one final destination. The block and the executioner's axe, seldom a swift end to the victim's life. Caught in the beady eyes of the tower's guardian ravens. It was in the tower that King Richard III imprisoned the two infant princes, Richard and Edward, the sons of his brother, King Edward IV. And it was here that he had them murdered. Certainly they were never seen again. The ghosts of the princes still haunt the bloody tower, forlorn in their nightgowns and holding hands. For the never-ending stream of tourists who visit the tower, one of the grimmest of its sights is the execution block on the green. King Henry VIII kept the axemen busy. Execution was a favoured solution to the political and marital difficulties the king encountered. In 1536, his second wife, Anne Boleyn, was arrested and sentenced to death on trumped-up charges. The Queen's house at the Tower had been built for Anne in 1530, but the only time she stayed there was while she was awaiting execution. Her headless ghost is still seen on the site. The grisliest ghost to haunt the site is that of the aged Countess of Salisbury, executed by Henry VIII in 1540. The old woman refused to put her head on the block and was hacked to death as she ran around the green. It is said that the shadow of a huge axe sometimes falls over the spot where she died. The Elizabethan courtier and adventurer Sir Walter Raleigh was imprisoned in the tower for 16 years under sentence of death. He enjoyed a measure of freedom within its walls, regularly strolling the battlements. Raleigh was housed in comfortable quarters. Here he busied himself with the writing of an epic history of the world. Sir Walter's own part in it came to an end in 1618, when, after a brief spell of freedom, he was executed for high treason. His ghost is still seen pacing the battlements, gazing out over the modern cityscape beyond. Or perhaps Sir Walter sees the spires and meadows of his own days in captivity. Another royal palace and another royal ghost. The gallery at Hampton Court is haunted by the ghost of Henry VIII's fifth wife, Catherine Howard. She was held in the palace before her own execution for adultery. The marriage had lasted barely 15 months. One night, Catherine escaped and had to be dragged shrieking from the doors of the chapel where her husband was at prayer. Her screams have echoed down the centuries and have been heard in our own day. Fulham Palace, ancient home of bishops on the banks of the Thames, is famous for its beautiful gardens, laid out in the 17th century, and for its ghosts. In the reign of the Catholic Queen Mary, its great hall was used by Bishop Bonner to torture Protestants. Bloody Bonner's own tortured spirit remains, as the warden attests.
He was dressed in a very long black cloak, a high wing collar going right up the back of the neck and round the ears. He carried on very slowly up the threshold of this net. Being that he was very tall, he had to stoop his head as he went through the door.
Glamis, the fairy tale Scottish castle of the Earls of Strathmore and childhood home of Queen Elizabeth the Queen Mother. Glamis has many ghosts, including that of Lady Jane Douglas, the so-called Grey Lady, who was burned as a witch in the 16th century. But Glamis also harbours a terrible secret, the details of which are made known only to the Strathmore heir on his 21st birthday. Legend has it that over the centuries a secret chamber has housed the hideously deformed descendants of the third Earl of Strathmore, a notorious libertine who was condemned by the devil to drink and gamble until Judgment Day. The story goes that if you hang sheets from every window in Glamis, there is always one which remains empty. Versailles, near Paris in France, the vast palace built by Louis XIV. Here in 1901, two English spinsters had a strange adventure. Charlotte Moberly and Eleanor Jourdain took a stroll in the gardens on a hot and thundery afternoon. There was a strange atmosphere about the place, as if the oppressive heat had somehow made the geometrically organized landscape almost two-dimensional. The walkers headed through the mock village built by Marie Antoinette, where the doomed queen had played at being a shepherdess. In an atmosphere almost tingling with static, they encountered a strange group of people dressed in 18th century costume. Had they stumbled through a gate in time to the eve of the French Revolution? The date was the 10th of August, the very day in 1792 when Marie Antoinette and her husband, Louis XVI, had been seized by the mob. Or had the two women been deceived by Parisian socialites in fancy dress? In August 1914, the summer thunder was drowned by the rumble of guns in the opening battles of the First World War. The British and the French rushed troops to the front to halt the German drive on Paris. At the moment when the Germans threatened to break through the British line at Mons, a fantastic apparition gave the outnumbered British soldiers heart. It was said that the sky had been filled with the ghostly figures of Henry V's archers, being led to victory at Agincourt by St. George. In fact, the vision had been invented by a British journalist, Arthur Machen, a student of the occult. But thousands of soldiers claimed that they had seen the figures in the sky. In the process, they became angels rather than archers. Similar stories circulated in the French and German armies. But by the time of the Somme offensive in 1916, with the casualties running in millions, there was not much comfort to be gained from the vision of the Angel of Mons. Yet the story has long outlived Arthur Machen and has become one of the persistent myths of the First World War. During that terrible conflict, the life expectation of aviators at the front could be measured in weeks. These confident, vigorous young men were lambs to the slaughter. At the height of the war in the air, there were many examples of what psychic investigators call crisis apparition. The sudden appearance of a loved one who is both far away and about to die. Early in the morning of the 19th of March 1917, a British airman, Eldred Boyer-Boyer, was shot down and killed in France. Less than 12 hours later, he appeared, smiling and seemingly as large as life, to his sister, a Mrs. Spearman, while she sat knitting in an hotel in Calcutta. Was some form of telepathy at work, triggered by family anxiety over the young airman and the trauma of his death in the skies over France? On her maiden voyage in 1915, The second officer of the German submarine U-65 was killed in an accidental explosion. The dead man did not desert his ship. He was seen at regular intervals on the deck, his ghastly white face turned up towards the men on the conning tower. The submarine was plagued by accidents and bad luck. The captain claimed it was all a practical joke, but the crew was convinced that the ship was haunted. On the 10th of July, 1918, U-65 was torn apart by a terrible internal explosion that was witnessed by an American submarine which had been stalking her. The U-boat's crew of 35 went down with her. Or was it 36? Certainly it was the last that was ever seen of the haunted submarine's phantom second officer. Today, the hillsides of the Tawy Valley in Wales are regularly buzzed by low-flying tornado fighter bombs. But in 1979, a more mysterious aircraft of World War II vintage was seen flying over the valley. It was a Wellington bomber. In the war years, Wellingtons were a common sight, but now there is only one left, housed in the Royal Air Force Museum at Hendon. Had the Tawy Valley Wellington crashed on a wartime training flight, but somehow remained airborne over 30 years later? Several witnesses reported that the bomber made no sound as it flew on its lonely mission, lost in space and time. RAF stations seem particularly prone to hauntings. The medium Eddie Burke was called in to solve a sequence of apparitions at RAF Linton-on-Ouse.
Just as I walked out of the door, a figure was stood just where you are, about 6 foot tall, quite broad-shouldered. It was a shadowy figure, and the figure just stayed there and then moved towards the left, towards the approach room door. A couple of months later, I was coming down from local, coming down these stairs, and, I just walked past this door here, and this figure was stood there again.
No.
Eddie goes into a trance in an attempt to contact the spirit.
The feelings I'm getting at the moment are that this man that you've seen was killed. I think somewhere in this vicinity, out on the airfield. I think it was just an ordinary accident. I think he was run down by a vehicle. At night. And his back was broken and he was in some considerable pain.
RAF records later revealed that in 1950 a young aircraftsman had been killed by a petrol tanker on a runway. Later, Eddie Burke was asked how he uses his psychic power.
And how does one use it? Well, I use it myself in order to help release entities, people, who have died and haven't progressed to the level they should have done.
There seem to be spirits aplenty at Borley Rectory in Essex, reputedly the most haunted house in Britain. In the early 1930s, the Reverend Lionel A. Foister moved in with his daughter, Marianne. Foister's journals record the strange events which ensued. They revolved around Marianne, who claimed to have been turned out of her bed and physically attacked by the forces at large in the dilapidated and sinister Victorian house, built, local legend had it, on the site of a medieval monastery. Scribbled messages in a childish hand appeared on the walls. Was Marianne the cause of this poltergeist activity? The Reverend Foister's journals record hundreds of incidents in which crockery disappeared and then returned, doors suddenly locked, and books flew off the shelves. Altogether, the Reverend Foister catalogued some 2,000 inexplicable incidents at Borley, most of them during his first 2 years there with Marianne. But the household at Borley contained secrets every bit as strange as the poltergeists which plagued the hapless man of God. The celebrated psychic investigator Harry Price came to the rectory in 1931 and concluded that the problems there were only of psychological interest. Had he sensed that something was awry at Borley Rectory? And what did he mean? Significantly, perhaps, the Reverend Foister had previously lived in Amherst, Nova Scotia, the scene of a famous poltergeist manifestation in 1878. Even more intriguingly, Marianne was not the Reverend Foister's daughter, but his wife. Marianne herself, who hated Borley Rectory from the day they moved in, was also bigamously married to a travelling salesman called Henry Fisher. Fisher lived at Borley with Marianne and the Reverend Foister in a ménage à trois. Marianne was to bear Fisher 2 children, but when war came, Fisher was supplanted by an American GI stationed in England. Marianne returned with him to America, where she disappeared from the pages of psychic history. The Foisters left Borley in 1935. Harry Price returned, this time to conduct research, which produced a book in which he claimed the rectory was the most haunted house in England. It burned down in mysterious circumstances in 1939. But ghosts can just as easily haunt modern airliners. In December 1971, a Lockheed TriStar, Flight 401, crashed in the Florida Everglades. It seems that some of its spare parts were used in other planes. Subsequently, there was a series of ghostly sightings of Flight 401's captain, Robert Loft, and second officer, Dan Repo, on several Eastern Airlines flights. Loft and Repo seemed to be trying to warn the flight crew about safety hazards. They had been unaware of the fault which had led to the crash of their TriStar. Had this disaster preyed so heavily on the spirits of the dead airmen that they were watching over the aircraft which contained the spare parts from Flight 401? The modern world of California has spawned a number of variations on ancient ghostly themes. Some of these have become lodged in the public mind as urban myths, handed down from teller to teller, much as ancient stories of vampires and banshees were in former times. In turn, these tales have spread around the world, giving us an insight into the ancient origins of ghost stories and how they persist in the era of the tower block and the internet. The old tale of the phantom traveler has been replaced by that of the phantom hitchhiker, the unaccompanied figure encountered on some lonely road who accepts a lift from a passing motorist and, while the vehicle is in motion, mysteriously disappears. Investigation of these incidents sometimes leads to the identification of people killed in car crashes near the spot where the hitchhiker was picked up. Sometimes they are accompanied by warnings of danger, rather like that of the airmen killed in Flight 401. Is it an old tale given a new twist, or another example of restless spirits reenacting tragic events? San Francisco is one of the most sophisticated cities in the United States, a cultural jewel on the West Coast and a magnet for tourists from all over the world. They come to enjoy the spectacular skyline on San Francisco Bay, the seafood restaurants of Fisherman's Wharf, and the superb scenery of the Pacific coastline. San Francisco's confident modern waterfront does not suggest the supernatural. And while the city's famous cable cars provide a link with the past, they are comforting enough. But in the bay itself, there is another, more sinister feature previously forbidden to the public. Alcatraz, the escape-proof prison which from 1934 housed many of America's most dangerous criminals. The grim prison on the rock was a place of pure punishment, from which there was no hope of escape. Pain and suffering soaked into its walls. Al Capone, Alcatraz's most famous inmate, went mad here from the effects of syphilis. He spent much of his time aimlessly strumming a banjo. The prisoner's cells were grim enough, but most dreaded of all were those set aside for solitary confinement, particularly those in cell block 14D, where men would be stripped and left in total darkness. In 1963, Alcatraz was closed as a prison and open to the public. Guards and tour guides have reported hearing the distant clang of metal doors, screams and sobbing. Cell block 14D has an inexplicably bitter chill to it. Today you can enjoy a dinner party in Alcatraz. Diners claim they sometimes hear the faint jangling of a banjo, a ghostly reminder of the days when Al Capone was lodged in this legendary prison. In the 1970s, books about London's ghosts began to include the tale of a 17th century vicar who haunted the docks at Wapping. But it turned out that he had been invented by a journalist, Frank Smythe.
Well, in fact, the whole thing, the vicar, the witnesses, is a complete fabrication.
Smythe was merely filling a column on a magazine devoted to the occult. But like Arthur Machen before him, his artfully contrived fiction was readily accepted as fact, and sightings were soon being reported. Perhaps the ghost of the evil vicar of Wapping really does exist. In the world of the supernatural, nothing is quite what it seems. Even today's ghost hunters are reluctant to commit themselves to what a ghost really is. The field is wide open to the machinations of fraudsters and the wild claims of the deluded. Were the events at Bawley Rectory stage-managed by the bigamous Marianne Foister? Or was there something more sinister at work in the old dark house? Were the hard-headed submariners of U-65 in the grip of a collective delusion? They were so panicked by the ghostly visits of their dead shipmate that a senior officer was called in to interview each man. He ordered the transfer of the entire crew to another ship, and the submarine was then exorcised. But on her second trip with a new crew, the spirit reappeared. There is a belief that some hauntings can be explained by the fact that traces of particularly intense or traumatic events are absorbed in the fabric of a building where they took place, and then, in certain circumstances, replayed. Is the Tower of London a huge stone tape recorder, waiting for the psychic button to be pressed, to give us fleeting glimpses of its extraordinary past? Mediums like Eddie Burke seem to be able to communicate with the restless spirits of the dead. Burke's sincerity is obvious, but even he would admit that the problems he unravels often leave him with more questions than answers.
Folks, That was Myths and Legends and Famous Ghost Hauntings. Now, I want to thank everybody for tuning into this series of shows. And next time you see me on Saturday, you're going to hear more Myths and Legends. Until eventually, they're all played and gone. I just want to let you know, though, that I don't really know the title names of each Myths and Legends show. I would actually play each episode, and then I gave it a title name in order to make it presentable on our show, and thus the names that I invented. Enjoy the series, though, my friends, and just don't be too scared when you walk down a hallway or into an eerie tomb. Better yet, stay out of the graveyard and stay home Halloween night and find some scary old-time radio shows to put on. Well, maybe you should just instead keep the light on and put on some soft music, but that takes all the fun out of Halloween. Peace out, my good friends, and we'll see you again. Also, I want to wish everyone a happy Halloween, including Louise. And isn't it time for Louise to come and close the show? I hear him now, softly tapping at my door. Louise, what do you have to say?